You're listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician.
Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 96 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, your host for the show, and on this episode, you're going to hear from Jack Conte of Pomplamoose. If you haven't heard of Pomplamoose, they're a band that have managed to build an enormous following for their music just from their creative usage of video. And they're not just making random videos, but a specific type of video that has become known as the video song. In a video song, the creation of the music goes hand in hand with what you see on the video. I'll let Jack explain more, but Pomplamoose, who rarely plays live and never tours, has truly tapped into the power of video with their video songs. I know you're going to enjoy this one, so let's get to my interview with Jack Conte. Well, joining me on the line is Jack Conte from the band Pomplamoose. Jack, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks.
Well, it's good to have you on the show. We've been talking a lot lately about how video is such an important part of the artist's music career as we move into the future. And when I saw what you guys are doing with video, and not just the videos, but how you're incorporating it into your store and things like that, I knew I had to have you on the podcast to talk about what you're doing and how video has become such an important part of getting your music out there. But before we get into that, why don't you tell us a little bit about your musical background and how Pomplamoose came about?
Okay, let's see. I started taking piano lessons when I was about 6. My dad taught me some blues stuff. I got into improvisation, and so I wanted to switch from classical to jazz. Started studying jazz and jazz theory, you know, around when I was 12 or 13, and then got to college and was still had the music bug. So I studied composition and computer generated algorithmic music, and in a program called Computer Science and Technology. Music Science and Technology. And then I met Natalie in college, and she was opening for a band that I was in, and I saw her music. She was playing bass, and there was a guy playing djembe, and she was singing, and it was instant love of both person and music. And we started working together right away, although we didn't become Pomplamoose right away. We were dating for a couple years before we actually put out a song together. And then we didn't really start as a band. We started just by collaborating. It was almost like me producing one of her songs. And then later on we started writing together, and then it sort of became time, you know, to kind of pick a band name, because I guess we were becoming a band, and then we did, and then it just sort of is Pomplamoose. So that's how it started.
What made you decide to make video such an integral part of what you guys do?
I don't want to say it was completely a business decision, because I've always been interested in film, and I wanted to was about to go to film school and declined at the very last minute in favor of staying with this pop band I was in at the time. But I was familiar with video. I had been watching YouTube. But the main push, the main reason, was because one day I was just watching through YouTube videos, and I saw all these videos of people playing guitar and singing, and they had 215,000 hits, 250,000 hits, 500,000 hits. And then I went over to my MySpace page and I saw 8 plays.
I know the feeling.
Wait a minute. I am barking up the wrong social media platform here. And so I wanted to try and figure out a way to incorporate my interests, which were orchestration and production, in the into the video dude with his guitar in front of a webcam kind of format.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the thing is, my forte isn't singing and playing, because I don't have a great, you know, a great voice, and I'd rather orchestrate it and do all the instruments, and that's kind of what I'm good at. So I was playing around with it for a long time, and then eventually sort of thought about just layering on lots of video and audio. And at first I tried doing it just raw, like on a camera,
mm-hmm.
and then imported camera audio, and that didn't really work. So I figured I'd just stick with my usual Pro Tools setup and sync up all the video afterwards manually. And it sort of grew in complexity and became the video song.
So when you guys started putting together Pamplemousse, were you ever a live performing band? I know when I go to your website now, there's no shows listed. It's all just the videos and ways right. to buy your music. Was that just your decision, like when you started the band, this is just going to exist solely in YouTube?
No, certainly not. Both Natalie and I have performance experience. The reason we don't perform very much is a business reason. If we spend the time that it takes for us to rehearse and relearn our music and put together a live show, if we instead put that time into recording a new batch of originals,
mm-hmm.
We reach 3 million people instead of reaching 400 people. And I guess the quality of the interaction is different because, you know, there's something to be said. There's a lot to be said for hearing something in person and live. I mean, you know, ultimately that's what music is about, or one kind of music is about, at least. It would lead to, you know, when we release a new batch of originals, it leads to record sales, and, you know, we quit our jobs a while ago, so we're just making our way off of record sales now. So we do have to stick to the model that works for us. Now we have a little bit of leeway because our sales are going pretty well, and if we wanted to, we could take the time and put together a live show and actually play live at this point. And we do every once in a while. We played a show a few months ago, and we're thinking about putting together another show for, you know, in LA maybe for, you know, in a few months from now.
Mm-hmm.
The other tricky part is one of the things about our music is that it's orchestration. You know, for me at least, one of the things I like about it is that it's orchestration. And I think the songs are good too. And the songs hold up by themselves on an acoustic guitar or a piano, or at least I like to think they do.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I like about it is that full sound and all those layers and all those things. And that's a tough show to put together. Let me tell you, get eight musicians in a room together, you know, glockenspiel, accordion, Wurlitzer, guitar, piano, three background vocals, multiple drum parts. You know, we would need, in order to replicate what we have on our recordings, we would need a room full of people and instruments. And that's a tough show to take on the road.
Yes, indeed. Well, I find it interesting just because I remember several years back when, you know, YouTube was becoming a big deal that people were saying, well, the internet still hasn't created a star yet or launched someone's career solely on the internet. And it seems like we're coming to the point where people are able to, especially through YouTube, like what you guys are doing, actually create a career that is solely based on just the internet as opposed to having to go out and hit the road.
Yeah, if I could just pontificate for a second here.
Go ahead.
if anybody out there is wondering, because I read an article today that depressed me. I felt so bad for musicians because it was, you know, it was saying, hey, musicians, if you're thinking about joining the Kanye Wests and Beyoncés and forming a band, let me tell you, all the glamour and hype is a bunch of bull, and here's how much money you actually make. And then it showed you the traditional, you know, 100-year-old record label pie that gets divided up, you know, 20% to distributors, 80%, you know, not 75% to the label, 5% to the band, split between five guys is, you know, one is like 3/4% each. And then out of that, you take lawyers' fees and accountants, blah, blah, blah. And it went on and on. And of course, the band ends up with like $200. And, you know, after a million sales. And that's, you know, that's if you don't have to recoup your $500,000 advance. So anybody listening out there who's interested in making a living as a musician, forget all that bogus nonsense. The model is changing so, so quickly and by the minute. And if there's one thing I've learned, it's that you know, we don't need gatekeepers anymore. Mm-hmm. We don't need someone discovering us. You don't need somebody to put their thumb up on the street and look at your face and say, ah, that's the guy. You know, you do it yourself. You make good things. If you make good, interesting music that you like, you know, if you like it and you really think it's great, the rest is going to follow. And you have to be honest with yourself. You know, it's hard. It's hard to be completely honest with yourself. But if you're really doing something that you believe in, you know, then the rest is just going to follow. And you don't need that little bit of luck from a label. You know, you don't need those connections. You know, I didn't have any connections in the music industry. Neither did Natalie. We just started posting videos. We did it completely ourselves. No management, no label. We get 100% of our royalties on everything. And it's, I mean, it's working great. I mean, you know, I just bought a house.
Wow.
And, I'm building a recording studio. And, you know, I'm not driving around in limousines and flashing Kanye West bling, but you know, neither Natalie nor I sort of want to do that. And, don't really need that to feel like we're, you know, doing good stuff as musicians. So
well said.
Here's my soapbox.
No, it was well said. We'll get back to some of the income streams a little bit later, but I wanted to ask you if someone actually coined the phrase video song, or what exactly are the rules to be considered a video song? I've seen that thrown around a lot with the style of videos you make, and it's
right.
Considered different than like just a band making a music video.
Yeah. So the actual term has two rules, and they're very simple rules. One is there's no lip syncing for instruments or voice. So if you see a take, that's the take that was actually used. So if
okay.
you see a vocal take, if you see somebody singing, it's not an overdubbed video over a previously existing audio track. That's the actual take that you're watching.
Oh, okay. That was one of my biggest questions, if I was seeing the actual takes of the video.
Yeah, that's the first rule of the video song. The second rule is if you hear something in the mix, even if you don't hear it, if it's in the mix, you get to see a clip of it in the video, at least for a short amount of time, but you get to see it. So there's no hidden sounds. There's nothing in the mix you don't get to see. And in that sense, it's kind of like a reveal of a magic trick. It's a little bit of a behind the scenes kind of secret of how to make these sounds, how to get things to sound like this. Here's the kinds of production. Even if, for instance, if you double a guitar track, you know, two guitar tracks playing simultaneously, things like that.
Or some of the things I've seen you do with the Deluxe Memory Man, where you're making a sound, it shows you actually tweaking
exactly.
the Memory Man. Okay.
Exactly, yeah.
When you're writing music and creating this, why don't you just take us through the process of how you go about putting this all together? Because when I see your videos, to me, it seems like, wow, that's a lot of work. And there's got to be, I mean, obviously it's, I'm sure it is a lot of work, but at the same time, I'm sure that you've learned ways to speed up the process and just be prepared to always, you know, be ready to go with the video camera.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, what we do is we don't sort of write it first and then film it and record it later. We kind of, usually the song, the general idea of the song is written first, maybe not all the lyrics, but, you know, most of the song is written first. And then we record we write and record the music as we produce it. So, you know, usually start with a drum track. I film the snare, film the kick. Sometimes I record live drums and I film the whole kit. Then, you know, Natalie and I decide together on a bass line, and we work on a bass and a piano part, or a bass and a Wurlitzer part, and Natalie records bass, and I'll record Wurlitzer, and we film the whole thing as we're recording it. And then sort of the rhythm section is down, you know, within a few hours, maybe 6 or 7 hours, we've tracked the rhythm section, drums, bass, and keys. And then the rest of it is adding the orchestration and the glockenspiel and the accordion and beefing up this section and making this section sound more full or making this section sound more quaint or whatever it is that we want to do. And that part usually takes another day or two of tracking. So we finish tracking and filming in usually 2 or 3 days total, sometimes less. Like our Lady Gaga cover was about 24 hours of tracking. 24 hours from start to finish, even including sleeping. We film as we go, and then once we arrive at a mix that we feel like, you know, we don't want to throw any more paint on the canvas, we do a bounce of the song from Pro Tools, and I send it to Natalie, and she starts lining up all the video that we've shot. She syncs it to the final mix track. And then once it's synced up, she edits it and makes it sort of nicer to watch by adding transitions and interesting cuts and cutting back and forth and putting multiple shots on the screen, mm-hmm. things like that.
How many cameras do you guys have running every time you're tracking like the drums or a vocal part?
So, it depends. You know, if we're tracking a single thing, we usually just record it from one angle. The reason is because we usually end up with maybe 20 layers, and it's hard enough to show 20 layers of audio.
Yeah.
You know, the rule is you have to show all 20 layers. So it's hard enough to show 20 layers of audio. If there were 40 layers, because you have multiple angles, it just would be too much. So we found that shooting with the camera works relatively well, unless it's a live performance. For some of our videos, Natalie will be playing bass and singing while I'm playing keyboard at the same time. And then in that case, we'll have 2 or 3 cameras rolling so that we can cut back and forth in sort of the more traditional live performance cutting style.
Are you just using regular handheld HD cameras?
Yeah. They're little consumer Canon Vixia. You know, one of them is actually we recently changed formats, which makes a big difference in the workflow, which I can explain if that's interesting at all.
Yeah, I find it interesting.
Okay, so we were shooting on Vixia. What are they called? Something or other. They're hard drive camcorders. So you shoot directly onto a hard drive inside the camcorder. There's no tapes, and that makes it really easy. Because you shoot something and then it appears as a thumbnail clip, and you can just browse through your thumbnails and you pick the right take, and then you've got it. But the only problem is there's a capturing step in there. You have to plug the computer you have to plug the camera into the computer after you've done recording, and sort through maybe thousands of clips and takes. Especially if you've got 2 or 3 songs going at the same time before you capture everything. So in order to eliminate that step, we bought a camera, which is a Vixia HV40, which allows us to plug the camera via FireWire straight into the computer. And instead of capturing on the camera, we capture on the computer while we're recording the audio.
Okay.
We have another computer station set up at the same time. We record directly onto that second computer station. Once we get a clip, once we get a take that we like, we name it right on the spot. This is guitar, good take, and we drop it into our good takes folder, and that's our guitar verse. And so then when we go to edit the song, all of our clips are named in order, ready to go. We just drag them right into the final cut timeline.
Are you just syncing them manually, like trying to line them up visually, or do you have some sort of method to sync the video to the audio?
We just line them up manually, visually. There's, you know, if you scroll through, Final Cut allows you to scroll through frame by frame.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can listen for a transient on the snare. You know, if you hear a ka, you know, you go right to the frame where you're smacking the head of the snare.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the audio track, and Final Cut will reveal the waveform of the audio track. You can see the snare, and you line it right up with where you smack the snare head.
Okay. So for a song, it can take you anywhere from 24 hours to a couple days, depending on how long and how much you put into it.
Exactly, yeah.
Why do you think the video song, just in your opinion, has caught on so well on YouTube? It seems like it's becoming this like genre of its own just on YouTube, with lots of people really interested in checking out other people's video songs and creating them themselves.
Right. I think there's a couple reasons for that. One, it's an educational experience. There's a lot of DIY musicians out there who want to learn about production and who want to learn about recording techniques and are interested in what other people are using. You know, stuff is changing so fast right now that it's tough to keep up to date on what's going on. And, you know, I watch other people's video songs for cool recording ideas, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, that's an awesome sound. And if you listen into a record in your car, you know, you hear a sound, you go, man, what a great sound. Gee, wish I knew how to make that, mm-hmm. you know. And when you're watching it on YouTube, it's, wow, what a great sound. I'm going to try that because I know exactly how to do it. And then you can put your own little twist on it. So so that's the first reason. It's a good educational experience. It's fun to, you know, it's fun to be able to pick out things that you enjoy and then to be able to replicate them yourself. The second reason is because everybody loves music, and people have loved music for, you know, tens of thousands of years. And now there's this, you know, short-form content is starting to catch on, you know, short-form videos. And it's become a really popular medium because short-form videos are entertaining. And it's, you know, quick little snackable moments in your day that pick you up and make you feel good. And to bring music into that medium has previously been the music video. The role of a music video. But the problem with music videos is they're hard to create on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. You have to be exceptionally creative. You have to sometimes spend a good chunk of cash. You don't always have to, but often the you know, videos that are interesting to watch, you know, or are good ideas, at least take a couple $100 or maybe $1,000 or $2,000, even on a low budget. It's just hard to keep churning out super creative music videos one after another. If you have an album full of songs, it could cost you $100,000 to mm-hmm. make music videos for that album. A video song allows you to make 10 music videos for next to nothing. You know, mm-hmm. maybe because you had to, you know, invest in a couple tapes or something for your camera. But if you have that, you know, it requires, like a recording studio, it requires an initial investment in Final Cut Pro. And then a camera, and then it's self-sustaining. You know, you can make as many video songs as you like, and I don't want to say it's robotic because that sort of has a negative connotation, but it's something that's really interesting to watch. That's almost mathematical to make. That's what I enjoy about it. I'm a really functional person, and as creative as the video end is, you know, it follows a strict set of guidelines, and it's almost like, it almost makes itself. You know, once you make the audio, the video can only be a certain thing. It can only be a certain way. And I think that's an easy thing to make since there's that set of clear rules and guidelines. And mm-hmm. it's a relatively small initial investment. And you can create short-form content on a regular basis to engage a fan base. That regular engagement of a fan base is super important because it's not just about one giant music video. It's about 10 or 15 little videos over the year that keep your fans interested in what you're doing and interested in your music. So I guess that would be why I think it's caught on as an interesting medium and as a good medium for musicians nowadays.
Yeah. When you started creating the videos, did you start out producing the cover songs? Because I know that one of the ways that a lot of people have discovered you is because of your cover versions of, like, I think Single Ladies was the first one that was getting passed around the office here, and there's a few others that I've seen. Did you start there? Was that something you were doing already and then decided, hey, let's try and do some interesting versions of cover songs?
Yeah, so the first video song the first time made a video song, it was for one of my original tunes. Both Natalie and I have solo careers, and we make video songs by ourselves as well. And it was an original, and we actually started, when Poplin started, we started with originals as well. Of course, covers are a great way to gain exposure and to, you know, help grow your fan base and help, you know, reach more people. So, we wanted to do a combination of covers and originals, which, you know, is a great debate for a musician because it can often feel you know, you can often feel like a moocher in the cover of a popular song. You know, but then I had to go back and think about how silly that is, because all, you know, my heroes have more covers than originals. You know, Frank Sinatra, Bill Evans, Brad Mehldau, you know, any of the great jazz piano players that I grew up listening to, and singers, Ella Fitzgerald, you know, Louis Armstrong, you know, tons and tons of cover tunes, and not just small cover tunes, huge hit songs, huge popular songs. And it's not limited to jazz groups. You know, the Beatles, their first three albums were like half cover tunes or more. So I mean, it's shooting yourself in the foot not to do it. It's just good business as a musician to be covering popular songs and to reach those people. In fact, I would say it's duty as a musician, because otherwise, you know, it's much harder for people to discover you and to discover your music. And at least for us, it translates. You know, when we come out with a huge cover song like the Beyonce or the Gaga song that we did, you know, those were our biggest months for original album sales. We have an original album out on iTunes, and the months that we came out with those covers were our biggest sales we'd ever had for our original tunes. So the covers are sort of a good business decision, and we're leaning toward making originals, because obviously, you know, we enjoy writing a lot, and we want to do that. So did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you tied that. I'm glad you tied it to those months being the ones where your original music sells the most, because it's CD Baby. We always say, hey, that's a good way to get noticed and good way to, you know, get cover song. People are searching for those songs. They discover your music. They like the way you sound. Doing that song they're familiar with, they'll check out your original stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you were on YouTube already, was it when you started doing those cover songs that you really started seeing the view count go up of all your videos?
Yeah, I mean, it was painfully clear. there was no question about it that doing a big cover song was the moment for us where we went from sort of not like small time, because we were making, you know, a living before that. But we went from, you know, 5,000 subscribers or 10,000 subscribers to 150,000 subscribers, which is, you know, it's 15 times the album sales. And it made a huge difference. It makes a huge difference. And also to, you know, to do a song with a million views, and if you're covering a song with a million views or 2 million views, you know, that's great, and it can gain you a lot of exposure. But just from a sheer business perspective, you know, when we were doing cover songs, it was like, okay, this song has 100 million views, let's cover that one. You know, and it just makes a big difference. And of course, we had to, you know, there's that initial filter, which is, do we like the song? Do we like the melody? We don't worry about the chords, because we completely reharmonize the chords anyway. So we don't listen to the harmony or the chords or the bass line or the orchestration or anything. Do we like the melody? Can we do something with that? And if the answer is yes, then our next question is, how many hits does it have? And if it has a shit ton of hits, then it's a good cover option for us. But we like to, you know, we like to include both, because we don't want to ultimately start covering songs that we just plain don't like. That would be no fun for us and not worth the money.
So you guys were already a part of the YouTube partner program before you started having these breakout covers get circulating the web. Is that correct?
It's sort of correct. Yes, we were, but it was through the umbrella of my YouTube channel. So we weren't technically our own partners, even though we were signed up for the partner program, because it was through my channel. But yeah, we were basically partners.
Because I saw that you guys did a video for YouTube advertising the partner program. What does it take to get involved in that and actually start making some revenue? Is there any specific guidelines that they put out in order for an artist to be accepted?
You have to put out a lot of original material. and you have to routinely get a lot of hits on that original material. I think YouTube is interested in partnering with people who are, you know, getting a thousand hits a week, you know, on their songs that come out, you know, or more. Because that's when you're going to start to see at least, you know, a little bit of revenue. And it's not going to be a lot, you know, at first. But, you know, it can eventually be a living if you're getting tons and tons of hits, like, you know, the What the Buck Show or Fred or Niga Higa, whatever those most popular channels are on YouTube. You know, those guys are making a living just off of ad revenue.
Mm-hmm. What percentage of your revenue comes from, like, the YouTube Partner Program, album sales? And obviously there's not really a live show revenue stream, but I'm just kind of curious what you said you're making a full-time living, what those main income streams are.
Yeah, so the main income stream is Pomplamoose album sales through iTunes. Then the next bit of income comes from, well, this year was our first time that we ever got some licensing deals. We did they used our cover of Sandman in a Toyota commercial, and that was a huge chunk of change that helped tremendously with everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, that was, again, the thing with licensing, though, is that it comes and goes, and it comes to you. It's not the kind of thing that you can guarantee, you know,
mm-hmm.
whereas at this point, if we release an album, we know it's going to sell at least, you know, a decent amount of copies. So, so we don't really count on licensing, but, yeah, it starts with iTunes, Pomplamoose album sales, then it goes to, through like eJunkie, which is PayPal and Google Checkout album sales.
Uh-huh, from like your direct, from your website.
Exactly, from the direct store, yeah. And that's probably the next thing. Licensing, if you can get it, is right up there. The YouTube revenue we're making, since we don't, to tell you the truth, we just enabled ads in our video like 3 weeks ago, so we don't really have a good sense of how much money it is. It's not like a ton of money. It's not as much as album sales, but it's a little bit of money, and it helps. If we were releasing more videos more frequently, which we plan to do at some point, then yeah, I think it would be better. But right now it doesn't compare it to our album sales.
So the only way you make money through the partner program is by allowing ads on your videos.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like they're paying you to produce content. What they do is they run an ad over your video and they split the revenue with you, that they get from their advertising partners.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure with all the success on YouTube and, a big licensing deal that you had for a commercial, what I would assume that people have approached you offering you deals, traditional record deals.
Right.
What's kept you from going down that path?
Yeah, well, when Single Ladies came out, we were approached by all four majors, actually, and we spent some time on the phone with them. We had a Sony publishing deal that was getting to the point where he was asking to talk with our lawyers and put together the paperwork, and we just didn't want to do it. So we backed out. But the reason is because, well, there's a bunch of reasons. This is where I get really passionate. The labels don't get it, and I know it's so, like, stereotypically indie hipster to say, you know, but they just don't get it, and it angers me. You know, we're making a living, like, you know, we're doing fine. We get to keep our album sales. What exactly is it that you think labels do for you? I have a bunch of friends in the music industry, in the music world, and you know, some of them play with signed acts and some of them are in signed acts, and the label gives them, I would say, half the publicity that Pomplamoose can give itself.
Mm-hmm.
by releasing a new video, we get millions of hits and a ton of record sales. And, you know, and then usually when we release a big video, we get some licensing deals that come in, and some of them come to fruition, some of them don't. But that kind of publicity that's available at your fingertips these days for free. You don't even have to pay to upload something onto YouTube. YouTube just lets you put video on their server and expose it to anyone you want. I mean, it's an amazing time that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And the back door around those gatekeepers is such an undervalued thing for musicians. So the reason we didn't sign the label, first and foremost, is because we don't need them. Anything they can do for us, they subcontract out to smaller organizations that we could pay for ourselves and then not have to recoup those expenses and hand over all of our finances to the label.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, if we want a PR team, which the label would just say, hey, you know, we have access to PR teams, we have access to distribution, we have access to publication, blah, blah, blah. Well, guess what? So do everybody. If you want to hire, you know, the label is just going to hire a PR team, and guess what? They're charging you for that PR team. You have to pay back that PR team out of your album sales, and it gets recouped behind your back. And you don't even get to see the books unless you audit the label. It's just such a backwards, antiquated, poorly designed system. That is meant, it's meant to fuck musicians. I mean, it's so bad. And none of them even know it. None of them even get it. They don't get the power of online video. They still call it viral video, which just like kills me. I love it when people say, hey, we're making a viral video. We got a call from a label the other day. It said, hey, we're making a viral video. Do you guys want to be in it? And we said, will you pay us? And they said, no, it's a viral video, so there's no budget. And we said, well, no thanks. You can't make a viral video. A viral video is something that happens. It has to do with the current culture and the current norms and the current blogs and whatever it is that's happening, you know, in society at that current time that causes it to expand like a virus. It's not something that you can decide. And the labels don't get that, and they don't get how video can be used on a regular basis for musicians. I mean, labels are still spending $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 on a music video. And if they were to spread that money across 10 videos that were more sincere and less smoke and mirrory and less flashy, then I think they would actually do way better with mm-hmm. the artist. Also, my experience with labels, I just did a production track for a major for Atlantic. I don't think I'm really supposed to talk about the details, but I sent them a track, and what they sent back to me, they said, okay, it's great, we like it, but can you change the chords and the chorus? I'd written this beautiful like 32 track string arrangement for them and had string players come over and record it live, and it sounded great, and it had these really cool hip jazzy out chords.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded fucking awesome. and they said, we want you to change the chords. And I said, no, I'm not going to change my chords. You know, if you want me to do the project, then you want me to do the project. If you want me to sound like somebody else, you want me to sound like someone else and go get that other person then. But, yeah, I guess deep down I have a problem with authority, but I want to make the music that I want to make. I don't want somebody telling me to change my chords. I don't want somebody telling me to change my anything. I mean, you know, ultimately artists are here to express themselves, not their corporate bureaucratic umbrella. So it just bothers me that the labels have that much control.
Well, I think what you guys have done with Pomplamoose, and even in your individual videos, you've got some great individual videos and great music that you do on your own, that it seems like you're definitely pointing towards the final turning of the tide. I mean, it's been happening for a while, but what you guys have been able to do and other artists that we've talked to, they've been able to, on their own, forge careers that make them a decent living and keep everything under their own control. It seems like that the future is definitely here with the artists being in control of everything.
Yeah, it's super exciting. It's just such an interesting time to be alive and making music, you know?
Mm-hmm. Where do you think video will go in the coming years? Do you think it's going to be something that is a necessity for artists or becomes even more integrated with the whole musical experience?
I don't know. It's such a, you know, who knows? How can anyone, anticipate that? Because it's just, I think a couple things. At least in the next year, I don't think video is going anywhere, hopefully. I think, you know, the mobile thing is going to catch on more. I mean, as much as it's catching on now, it still isn't the main chunk of video. Mm-hmm. And as soon as Apple decides to launch their plan to take over the world, I think, you know, we'll all have iPhones and we'll all be watching videos and we'll all be listening to cloud-based subscription music services. And it's really going to change, you know, everybody's business model. Mm-hmm. I think video is going to stick around. It's just such a fun thing because 10 years ago, you know, if you were to have a dinner party and you were to say, hey, does anybody want to watch some short films after dinner? You know, everybody would say, oh, you know what? I'm getting tired after work. and that was 10 years ago. That was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Short form content is a brand new. It just out.
Yeah.
And it's a baby. The medium is a baby. And so who knows where it's going to go? I mean, in 5 years, it's changed so much. The fact that it even exists in the kind of ubiquitous setting that it does is just unbelievable. And that happened so quickly. So, in 5 years, I hope there's video. I think it's probably going to be more like gaming and interactive, experiences mm-hmm. for users where they're playing or they're adding something maybe to the video or to the music, or they're choosing the angle from which they want to watch the video being created, or they're racing a car through a canyon and there's, you know, and the speed of the car has to do with the pace of the music and the turns have to do with the orchestration or, you know, whatever it is. There's all these kinds of games, like Guitar Hero and there's a bunch that I can't even think of, but that have successfully integrated music discovery and gaming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be a huge part of the video and audio experience for users in the next, you know, 5 or 10 mm-hmm. years. And how that's going to be monetized by artists, I don't know. But I'm sure it will be because people listen to music and people love music. And as long as music continues to have value in society, there's going to be a way to monetize it. So I think a smart musician is always going to be able to figure out a way to make a living in the current climate, you know, no matter what it is.
Well, well said. That's a good point to end on. I appreciate you taking time out of your day to be on the podcast, and we'll definitely be watching what you're doing with video.
Sure. Thank you for the awesome questions, by the way. It was one of the best interview questions we've ever gotten.
Well, if you haven't seen some of Pomplamoose's videos already, you'll want to head over to their YouTube channel and check them out. I'll put a link to it in the show notes for this episode, which you can find at cdbabypodcast.com. I'd love to hear your reaction to this episode. Are you excited about the usage of video? Do you hate the idea of having to incorporate something like video in order to reach a fan base? You can weigh in at our listener line at 206-426-5683 with your thoughts and comments. Keep your comments to about a minute or two and we'll try and get them on the show. You can also email us at info@cdbabypodcast.com. Well, that's going to do it. We'll catch you next time. You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.